Okay, great. So as John mentioned, my name is Natalie. I'm at the Institute for Nuclear Theory. So my background is more in terms of how you calculate properties of gauge theories and of highly correlated systems. And now we're asking the question of whether you can use a quantum device in any way to aid in those calculations. So I'm going to start off with a big number to remind us of some of the scales that we're working with. So 10 to the 100 is the estimated number of fundamental particles in the universe. And if you go ahead and imagine that you could store a continuous complex number on each one of those fundamental particles, which you cannot, but let's humor me for a moment, then if you created a classical computational framework out of those fundamental particles, you could store the quantum wave function of about 300 or so qubits. So there's a large discrepancy in these scales, the size of the universe versus around 300 qubits. And the importance there is that there's a physical fundamental difference in the types of systems that we're talking about. And to bring these down to some kind of more manageable length scales, once you get to around 50 qubits, you're looking at 16 petabytes of memory just to store the state. So these are some magnitudes that are motivating us to try and use these fundamentally different systems. And in my place at the Institute for Nuclear Theory, I tend to be motivated by some calculations of nuclei. And here, I just wanted to bring to your attention some estimates of computational resources that were estimated in 2016. They were kind of looking at the 10-year time scale and saying, well, if we wanted to calculate things like charge radii and three nucleon forces to the precision that is relevant for experimental explorations, then what is the necessary computational resources I need in terms of these exaflop system years, both capability, so the entirety of the exaflop device, or capacity, so starting to parallelize that system. And for these features, you ended up needing around 10 capability exaflop system years to calculate two experimental precisions. So these are non-trivial calculations, but for these, this is actually in a positive footing. These are systems where we have algorithms and have devices that are being projected on timescales of 10 years or so, where we know an algorithm that will get us to the precision we're looking for. There are other systems in nuclear physics that motivate me where we don't have algorithms or projected devices where we expect to be able to match on to experimental precisions. And this slide kind of gives a pictorial representation of these systems that kind of motivate me in this area. So real-time evolution of quantum systems, which I will discuss a little more today. Fragmentation functions, so describing the way that the quark and gluon degrees of freedom end up being measured in the color singlet hadronic degrees of freedom at the detector. And finite density systems, this is kind of a pictorial long-range plan of some of the systems that are motivating the work that I'll tell you about. So before I jump into the work that I'm going to tell you about, this is one slide of a bit of history. This history is in what's called QCDOC, or QCD quantum chromodynamics, the strong interactions on chip. And so this piece of history is to emphasize that the nuclear and particle physics community is very in tune with the idea that they may have to design a new computational framework in order to approach the problems of their interest. So, a decade or so ago, researchers in lattice gauge theory realized that they understood their calculations very well. They understood their memory requirements. They understood what kinds of communication they would require, how large those communications were, and when those communications would occur. And so they realized that they could build specialized hardware in order to do those calculations more efficiently. And so this is a picture of one of these motherboards. The nodes on this motherboard are actually connected in a torus to match with the connectivity that they wanted in the lattice calculation. And these actually opened up a new era, or much new physics, that could actually be explored with these devices. And now if you look on some of the IBM BlueJeans connectivities for their HPC devices available today. They're still connected in Tori, as an aspect from this QCD simulation. So, inspired by this history, we like to stay in contact with experimentalists in our research. I spoke about it yesterday at IQC, some of the experimental efforts that we've been doing implementing gauge theories, small instances of gauge theories on quantum devices. But as we do so, we're thinking about the future and what kind of devices and what kind of properties of these devices might be useful for nuclear physics applications. Okay, so this is a slightly overwhelming outline of my past 2 days of talks. This left half were implementations of gauge theory, so the Schwinger model and SU2 gauge theory that we implemented on superconducting devices and also a photonic system that I discussed yesterday. Today I'll be discussing a little bit different system, a scalar field system, and the way that we were able to design a calculation that actually localized the quantum algorithm, just like the localized entanglement or the localized correlations in the field. Okay, so where are we going to start? First of all, why am I going to talk to you about scalar field theory? The motivations, at least in the quantum simulation world, have really been heralded forward by Stephen Jordan, Keith Lee, and John Preskill. In some of their seminal papers on simulating the scalar field. And in one of their earlier papers around 2014, but I think it was around 2011 when it first appeared, they end up describing an algorithm for a relativistic scalar quantum field theory that runs in a time that is polynomial in the number of particles, their energy, and the desired precision, and applies at both weak and strong coupling. So this represents an exponential improvement for systems at strong coupling. And then beyond, adding in Hari Krovi in their later work just last year or so, they realized that if you add in space-time dependent classical sources into this scalar field, you actually get a BQP complete system, which means that any problem that can be done polynomially on a quantum computer can be mapped efficiently into the scalar field and calculated as a scalar field problem. So, two reasons to be interested in the scalar field beyond the physics reasons of connections to Higgs particles, etc. So, how am I going to do a scalar field for you today? Well, we're going to think about our scalar field as digitizing a continuous number at all points in space. And so, at every point in space, I need some type of quantum register telling me what the value of this scalar field is at that point in space. And you're going to have four terms in your Hamiltonian. The first term is the first two terms are both local to these points in space. It's a conjugate momentum and a field term. So if you only had these two points, you would basically have a harmonic oscillator sitting at every point in space that was uncoupled. And so the ground state of this system with the first two terms in this Hamiltonian would just be a tensor product set of harmonic oscillators, with a ground state that's a tensor product of Gaussian wave functions. Okay, the next term we're going to add in is a gradient operator, and that's in position space. So this couples the harmonic oscillators sitting at various points in space. And that term is what's going to take us from a ground state that's a tensor product state to a ground state that is entangled. And now your ground state, still as a free theory, is a correlated high-dimensional Gaussian. You can then add in interaction terms, and this is going to be beyond towards some of this BQP complete calculations, but for the point of this talk, we're not going to introduce that yet. Okay, so now we have these kind of blobs of qubits sitting at every point in space, and they have to represent some continuous number at each point in space, and you can ask how are those qubits going to represent the scalar field? And there have been multiple discretizations or digitizations that have been explored over the years. The one that was proposed in the Jordan Lee Preskill papers is say, just take your field, you have field values, you're going to put a cutoff on the maximum field value, plus and minus, and then you're also going to digitize that field just as a grid. So you have two numbers defining this digitization, a phi max, so the maximum value of your scalar field, and also a lattice spacing in field space. Since then, there have been alternate proposals, some of which I have explored to either go into momentum space, to go ahead and say, well, I know this system is very close to a harmonic oscillator, so maybe I'll just use harmonic oscillator wave functions. And it turns out that in a comparison, say, between the harmonic oscillator wave functions and the JLP kind of digitized space, of course, one of them might have better qubit counts, but when you start looking into the time evolution, which we might want to do if we're looking into a scattering event, I'm going to throw some numbers at you real quick, but you can focus on the ones in red. We did a very detailed analysis to figure out exactly how many qubits and how many gates and operators you need to represent that time evolution in these different bases. So whether you represent your field as just a digitized space, or you represent it as a harmonic oscillator basis. And it turns out that by choosing a different basis, you can end up with orders of magnitude more of these CNOT gates, or more of these two-qubit entangling gates. And it turned out that in a number of ways, you could change these resources that you needed by making small modifications to the way that you digitize, the exact details of how you truncate in your system. On the left, I've shown just a pictorial example of one thing that made a large difference, which was in the way that we implemented the quantum Fourier transform. So recall we had these two operators, the conjugate momentum operator and the field operator, the mass term, and they're both acting on this kind of blob of qubits sitting at one site. One of them is diagonal in position space, one of them is diagonal in momentum space, and you can do a quantum Fourier transform between these two spaces. You can implement your mass term in field space, do a quantum Fourier transform, and then implement your conjugate momentum operator in momentum space, which is also now a diagonal operator. and this kind of connects your momentum and your field space. So it turns out, if you symmetrize this operator, which I'm not going to go into too much detail of what that means, but if you symmetrize this operator, you can actually reduce your quantum resources fairly significantly. So this was all to emphasize that small choices in the way that you represent a quantum field onto qubits can actually dramatically, in some cases by orders of magnitude, change the cost of the quantum simulation. So with all that said, I'm going to choose this Jordan-Lee-Preskill basis of representing a scalar field. The nice features of this that I'm not going to go into horrible detail is that the field operator, or when I ask this blob of qubits what the value of the field is sitting at that site, the field operator in this basis happens to be a single qubit operator. So it goes and it acts on each of these qubits in the site individually. And as such, the phi squared term, so the momentum or the mass term, is actually going to be just a two-qubit operator. So if you notice in this chart that there were three-body and five-body and six-body operators that don't appear in the JLP, this Jordan-Lee-Preskill basis, that was by design. And that design actually allows us to make sure that we can time evolve this system efficiently with only polynomial resources. Okay. The last point about the basis before I go on and tell you about the quantum simulation of this is that you end up with Nyquist-Shannon saturation, which is a really clever sampling tool that was actually realized around the 1930s. And so it was clearly not designed for quantum simulation in the 1930s, but what it was designed for in the 1930s was for digitizing analog signals. So the statement goes, if I have a continuous signal with a finite bandwidth, where in this case I'm going to reinterpret the signal as the field, and the finite bandwidth is going to be a finite momentum space or finite conjugate momentum, which I've naturally made finite by truncating and putting this thing on a lattice, then I have a finite temporal sampling rate that I need to make in the signal space, which is going to map onto a finite field sampling rate. So I said there were two parameters that were digitizing the field, and that's this cutoff of the maximum field values and also some kind of lattice spacing telling me how finely I'm sampling that field. And so this Nyquist-Shannon saturation point tells me that after I get to a particular point, which is defined by the largest momentum in that finite bandwidth, then improvements to my representation of the field are going to be exponentially small. And this is basically, you can think about it in Fourier modes as well. So at some point, you've sampled enough coefficients, or you've sampled enough information to define all of your Fourier modes. So as such, this is just going to be on the y-axis, I'm going to give you the number of qubits, or in this case, the states, number of quantum states, and on the x-axis, and on the y-axis, I'll give you the precision of the ground state wave function. And if you start with a gradient operator, so that's that momentum operator that's connecting you between sites, that's correlating your harmonic oscillators. If I start out with something that's nearest neighbor local, you have polynomial errors, so it scales down. You can actually improve those polynomial errors by delocalizing this momentum operator. But then if you go ahead and do the quantum Fourier transform, which is now efficient on a quantum device, you get this point where you see exponential convergence, and this is your Nyquist-Shannon saturation point right here. So this is a way in which the Nyquist-Shannon saturation point is informing you how to best use your quantum resources. It tells you to tune your representation of the scalar field to this point. And if you wanted to go to larger systems, you should not be adding states. You should be modifying your definition of the state. So last slide on this is that if I go ahead and change my cutoff of the field, so I'm going to expand how much of the field I'm going to capture, then you end up seeing double exponential convergence with the number of qubits that you use. Okay. And this double exponential convergence was known by Jordan Lee Preskill and is why you get some speedups in the scalar field quantum simulation.
Let's assume everything is perfect, right?
This is assuming everything is perfect. Yeah. Yep. So at the moment, there's no noise in any of this. Actually, this purple triangle with a transistor sitting at the top is basically saying that any data you see on these plots is classical, simulated on my laptop. There's no quantum noise being considered here.
Is it known what happened if there's some imprecision around?
What happens in terms of...
If the simulation, like the quantum computer that you use to do this simulation or this calculation, if there's some small amount of noise, is it at least known that in principle, it's not going to change the complexity in terms of the doubly exponential conversions, or it's unknown? How sensitive?
I have not applied specific noise models to testing that double exponential convergence. However, if you imagine your noise models either shifting you in the number of states that you have available to you that you can access with your imperfect gates or your imperfect representation of the Hilbert space, then it's more sensitive in some directions than it is in others, but that exploration has not been done. No. But at this point, we're just defining optimally in a clean system what basis we should be using. Okay, so that was me giving you some idea of what I mean by representing the scalar field onto some qubits. With the next, 15 or 20 minutes, I'm gonna go into a recent paper that I find kind of exciting, which is a paper on systematically localizable operators. So this was a desire to actually embed some of the physical properties of the scalar field that we know into our ability to prepare the ground state of the scalar field. Right? So for any quantum simulation, there's a step one, which is prepare the state. There's a step two, which is time evolve the state and then measuring it. I was just telling you about the nice properties of this basis for step two for the time evolution. And now I'm going to go into step one of how you actually prepare these ground states. So imagine that I prepare a ground state for scattering. And if that ground state has some kind of approximations or some errors and noise, that noise is going to come out in my calculations to simulate, say, a scattering event as background processes that I need to isolate the system that I care about from. So if you can get your state preparation very clean to start with, this makes your life easier down the road. So we've looked into this before in actually making some approximations to the ground state of the scalar field, which is approximations to, say, Gaussian or localized wave functions. And in doing so, we came across how to do it perfectly or without approximation. And of course, as you might expect, without approximation, it requires exponential resources to make an exponential wave function. So this is one way of doing it that I'm going to build off of. And so let me tell you what all of these features mean. So each of the lines is a qubit, and each of the boxes with an R inside of it is just an RY rotation with some angle. All the controls are these circle dot controls, and what that really means is I want one circuit for each possibility of that control, or one circuit element for each possibility of that control. So for the R theta 1 vector, there are actually two operators that I get from that, one controlled on the zero state, one controlled on the one state. For the two circle dot controlled operators, I get four. And as you go on and add controls, you get 2 to the L, where L is the number of these controls. Okay. So apparently you need an exponential number of these rotation operators. And we can actually solve for these angles quite easily. It's not really important how you do it for this talk, but I wrote it here in case you're feeling interested. And so to implement this circuit, we end up needing an exponential number of rotations, but also an exponential number of these two qubit entangling gates. And it gets even a little hairier that if on the x-axis I'm plotting the magnitude of these rotations as calculated in a scalar field ground state. And the scalar field ground state is on 10 sites, so I have 10 spatial locations in one dimension, and I've put 2 qubits to digitize the value of that field at each of these locations. And so I can calculate those values of angles theta to build that ground state as a quantum circuit. And on the y-axis, we're looking at h, where h is the distance, the number of these controls in the operator. So these large h objects, so h equals 19, has 19 of these controls, and there's 2 to the 19 of them. Okay. So there's translational symmetry in here, which is kind of nice, but there's really no hierarchy. So the 2 to the 19 circuit elements are just as important as the very local smaller elements in the circuit. Which you can imagine is painful theoretically, but also painful to put on hardware anytime soon. So I'm going to fix this with this talk. It gets even worse, actually, than that, which is that this little dot on the odd-numbered, odd-distance controlled operations is not actually just a dot of a few operators. It's actually half of the rotations in that level are actually sitting in that dot around a rotation angle of pi over 2. And so half of your rotation angles are sitting with very large rotation angles. So none of this is truncatable or sitting in any type of hierarchy. Okay, so that's clearly not getting across this idea of our field theories having finite correlation lengths. If I think about something that occurs here in Waterloo and something that occurs in Seattle, those two things should have a very small correlation. And this circuit is telling me that my long distance operators are just as important as my short distance operators. So that's not quite fitting into my physical understanding of the field. So just like in our architecture, we like to make the form of our structures follow their function, I'm going to make our quantum circuits correspond to correlations in the field. So first we need to know what those correlations in the field are. And so I've written up here the structure of the ground state. It's that correlated Gaussian, high-dimensional Gaussian. And this correlation function can be calculated on the lattice. It's this first Bessel function. And if you plot it here, I'm plotting it for a system with periodic boundary conditions. So at half the space, you see the longest distance interactions, and they tend to fall as e to the minus mr, where m is the mass of the lightest particle, or the mass of the scalar field here. So you have something exponentially decaying. And I'm going to put on a couple other measures of the correlations. So I'm going to put on the two-point correlation function. It's a very natural set of correlations that incorporates both the quantum and the classical correlations in the field. I'm going to put on the mutual information, which is a very natural quantum extension to the classical ideas of entropy. And I'm also going to put on this plot, the negativity, where the negativity was inspired not too long ago, I think around 2003, as a computable measure of entanglement. And it was inspired by the realization that the positive partial transpose happens to be a necessary condition for separability. So of course, if you're trying to represent how far away you are from separability, you can then represent how far away you are from having a positive partial transpose of the density matrix. So I've put two of those things on there. So the two-point correlation function also falls as e to the minus mr. It's the black line there. The mutual information, still representing quantum and classical correlations, falls as e to the minus 2mr in this ground state of the scalar field. And for the negativity, I'm going to shift the representation of this plot, and you'll see it in a moment. The axes are still the same, but it's just going to be this top corner, and we're going to do box plots instead. And that's because the negativity is actually hyper-localized. The negativity is non-zero only at the UV length scales. And by UV length scale here, I'm actually meaning what we inserted as the definition of the gradient operator. So that nearest neighbor finite difference operator giving us a momentum in our field. So if you do a nearest neighbor digitization of your gradient operator, you get the blue piece where your negativity is only zero at the distance scale of your interaction, which is two sites. You can smear your gradient operator, which modifies your UV physics and leaves your IR physics perturbatively close. And then you can see smearing also in this negativity property. Okay, so this is kind of phenomenology of the scalar field ground state in terms of its correlations. And if we can make a quantum circuit that has any one of these structures as its localizing operators, we would be winning. So I'm going to show you how I do it, and then I'll show you which of those decays we were able to capture. So for each one of these highly controlled rotation operators, I'm going to do something that seems very wrong, which is that I'm going to actually double the number of operators for each of these operators. And what allows me to do that is some motivations from physics and some motivations from localizing these operators, which is to rewrite this highly controlled operator as a series of lower controlled operators. And this is where we get into these angles that we call alphas. And the alphas can be calculated from the thetas in this way, that all you really need to know is that they're linear combinations of the thetas. Okay. So we've blown up our already exponentially large quantum circuit into an exponentially large quantum circuit with twice the number of elements. And this seems like a bad idea, but I'll convince you why it's not a bad idea. So let's try this out with two very simple states, just to see what the two representations of preparing these two states looks like. The first one is the GHZ state, and the second one is this W state. So I'm going to remind you of some of the entanglement properties of these two states. For three particles, these two states actually kind of represent the two different types of entanglement that you can have in three particles. And the GHZ is a fragile type of entanglement in the sense that if I trace out one particle, then all the correlations that are left over happen to be classical correlations. And the W state is referred to as robust in the sense that if I trace out one particle, I can still have non-trivial entanglement in the remaining reduced density matrix. And these two types of entanglement cannot be mixed through local operations. So distinct types of entanglement. And so if I take this original circuit with the thetas and ask, you know, what does it take to initialize this GHZ state? Well, it takes a non-zero operator at the top, and then for each of these operators, I need half of my 2 to the L operators at each level. And so it's still exponential. It's half as large as the system you started with, but I need an exponential number of them. And if you are aware of circuit representations of quantum states in any way, you would object right now, because the GHZ state can actually be initialized very simply with a Hadamard rotation on the first qubit, and then single qubits, two qubit interactions. You're laughing, so you know, apparently.
I was indeed confused.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I'm relieved to know that. Circuit complexity.
Yes. Okay. So right. So you should have been confused, because this is not the way to do the GHZ state. So what you do for the GHZ state is you start with a single qubit rotation, and then you have 2 qubit CNOT gates, these 2 qubit entangling gates between nearest neighbor qubits all the way down, and this should be sufficient to prepare that GHZ state. So when you do this action that I told you about to blow up this quantum circuit and turn into the alpha angles, indeed you get back into having a single qubit rotation, this alpha zero at the top, and then the only alphas that remain have single controls at the top. The W state is a bit different. Recall its entanglement is more robust, and if you calculate the operators you need in this theta circuit, this original circuit, the operators that you need, there's one at every level. So there's one at every distance for each qubit. And so since we know that the alphas are just linear combinations of the thetas at each level, there's actually no localization you can do. And so the W state requires a fundamentally different type of state preparation circuit than the GHZ state. So in this sense, we can be encouraged that this type of state preparation of transitioning into these alpha angles is actually following the entanglement structure or the correlations that are sitting in our quantum state. Okay, so this is the plot that I told you that I would fix. Along the x-axis, again, we're looking at this time the alpha angles, so the angles that are sitting in this quantum circuit. And on the y-axis, we're looking at their distance, so how many qubits away things are sitting. And now you see a suppression of these systems that are sitting at 19 controls are suppressed actually exponentially by an exponential that's controlled exactly by the mass of the scalar field. Our operators are being systematically suppressed by orders of actually this correlation matrix that we looked at first, the correlation matrix that's giving us how our harmonic oscillators are being correlated. And it's doing so exactly correlated with the distance of those operators. So high body operators or non-local operators can be truncated in a systematic way. And I showed you this plot before, that we no longer have half of our operators sitting at large pi over 2 size values. They fall very, very nicely throughout the spectrum. But it's not only that our operator rotation sizes are getting smaller, it's actually that we can build states with higher fidelity. So if you look at this, the original angles that we were looking at, these are the theta angles. On the bottom, I'm adding in angles to approximate the ground state, or to approximate the, I'm adding in circuit elements, so truncating the circuit. And when I have a very small circuit, I put in the circuit elements that are nearest neighbor first, and all the small ones. So you can think, if I was doing this on hardware, These would be the easiest ones to implement. And so these are the ones with lightest color that come in first. And it's not until I introduce the angles that are sitting at distance 7 in this case, or these long distance operators, that I actually start getting my fidelity to improve. However, when you transfer into these alpha angles, you can get your fidelity to improve by orders of magnitude over the theta angles, even when you only have short distance operators. Okay. So we've actually embedded a hierarchy of localizable operators into our scalar field initialization. So the last piece of data is just to look at this for larger and larger systems. This is back to that 10 site system where I'm plotting the fidelity as a function of H truncation. So let's say I'm working on some hardware that can't entangle qubits beyond 4 away. I can do a truncation including only distance 4 operators, and as such, I'm sitting on a curve that is exponentially improving in the fidelity of the ground state of the scalar field. Okay. So kind of the last piece that I wanted to share was that these ideas of localizing your operators or localizing your quantum circuits, given the entanglement structure and the correlation structure that's sitting in your quantum field theories, is an idea that will extend to 2- and 3-dimensional spaces, not just the 1-dimensional space that we worked with here. So this is encouraging in starting to think about how to quantum simulate higher dimensional spaces. So with that, I'll just leave you with a statement of what we've done. So we've created a quantum circuit that's been defined with localizable quantum elements, scaling with the two-point function, or the two-point correlation function, and our errors in that system quantified by the fidelity of that state preparation is being systematically controlled when you truncate. So that's my main very small message, but I guess the larger message is that here in the NISQ era, when we start to have these small devices that we can play with, we can actually begin developing some intuition of how to insert our physics ideas and our physics understanding of these systems into our quantum simulations. Thanks.
Yeah. We have plenty of time for questions. And I'll start. So I'm wondering, so there's a folklore open problem asking to simulate a spin, basically getting an exponential speed up for simulating a spin in the sense that I can simulate this. But can I simulate a spin whose total value is, say, the exponential of the number of qubits? Do you think any of these methods might allow you to, say, simulate an exponentially large spin?
Sorry, and by an exponentially large spin, you mean not a spin 1/2, but a spin 2 to the n?
Yeah. So it's sort of been, I would say it's a folklore open question maybe for the last 20 years. People have thought about it, but there's never been any sort of a rigorous.
Okay, so I'm 20 years behind. I'm thinking about this, I think.
So I'm wondering if you have any, any sense in which just kind of holding on to the relevant degrees of freedom might enable something.
I have not thought about it. I can imagine how having a system where you're truncating in some basis may be useful there, but I'm not sure what the hierarchy is in terms of those 2 to the n different spin degrees of freedom.
Right, because like, for example, doing a rotation about the z-axis sort of reminds you of your, you kind of have this thing where you can kind of have exponentially smaller spins. You can easily do a z rotation. Trying to do anything else is something that's still open.
You'll have to point me to some of the 20-year history on that.
There's not even much literature in the sense that people haven't made much progress.
Okay.
I can tell you that sort of thing.
Okay. So by folklore, you really meant folklore.
Yeah. Okay. People don't make enough progress to write on.
Okay.
Maybe I'll ask another question. So where do you see this going in the longer term? So like what, where do you hope we might be to 10 years from now? Just kind of say.
Okay, so a funny thing about quantum simulation talks is when there's like an absence of questions, the question always becomes for the speaker to prognosticate about about what will happen. And I'm still not good at it. And I tend to be, I'm just very not good at it. okay, so I'll give you that. You know, at the moment we're still at an era where we're not actually sure how quantum devices fit into our simulation capabilities at all. So, as you may have picked up, we're representing the entirety of the scalar field on a quantum device. But there has been great progress in simulation of lattice gauge theories on classical devices. That can do significantly larger systems than any system I can imagine to do in the near term on quantum devices, right? And these calculations can calculate the charge radii of nuclei and binding energies and many properties to high precision. So I would hope in the next 10 years or so, we might have a better idea of how these two capabilities of actually doing dynamics in these quantum systems and capturing some of the quantum properties of the device might be married more closely to the capabilities that we already have in the classical calculational devices.
Like, might you foresee some kind of, not the all seeing one?
I'm certainly not.
Maybe,
no.
Maybe more than we are. Might you foresee some sort of hybrid classical quantum architecture? So I know that I've
yeah.
seen such things proposed for quantum chemistry before.
Yes, and as far as my perspective, a lot of the approaches in that area are quite successful at the moment, and they are being designed around variational based algorithms where you're representing the quantum system still on. Or completely on the quantum system, and the classical device is being used as an optimizer to go ahead and fix the way that you're preparing the quantum system. So that I think is on in the right spirit and on the right track, but there's still this very large divide in which system is representing the field theory in this case, or which system is representing the quantum system that you want to simulate, and which one is controlling it. Anyway, I think we'll have a number of new ways of thinking about these systems in the next 10 years or so, I hope.
Great. Any other questions? Okay, we'll let you out of the hot seat. Thanks again, though. Great talk.
Yeah, okay.